So before turning to our panelists, let me make just a few observations of my own about our topic. You may have read recent accounts of events in Pakistan, such as an article that ran a few weeks ago in the New York Times under the headline, "Suspension of Jurist Unleashes Furor Against Musharraf." President Musharraf had suspended the country's chief justice, sparking a huge reaction among both the bar and the general public. Lawyers gathered by the hundreds outside the Supreme Court building in Islamabad wearing black armbands and headbands and demanding the president's resignation. One Pakistani columnist explained the source of the crisis. Chief Justice Chaudhry, quote, "began to take the constitutional guarantee of judicial independence too seriously and began to poke the judicial finger into holy waters," the columnist wrote. Another recent headline, "Another Ecuador crisis deepens as a judge is fired ahead of voting." Now, I'm sure you're all thinking to yourselves, thank heavens things like that can't happen here. And of course they can't. The challenges that our judicial independence faces in the United States are rather more nuanced and subtle. For that reason, they may be a good deal less visible to the average person. But they are consequential nonetheless, and they're not always so subtle. Most of us in this room probably don't spend much of our time glued to right-wing talk radio, but a constant drumbeat of judge bashing in that medium, as well as on the internet, fueled a movement that placed a referendum on the ballot in South Dakota last November that would have amended the state constitution to eliminate judges' immunity from prosecution for their decisions and to set up a special grand jury to censure judges. The referendum failed. But the California-based group that sponsored it, which calls itself Jail for Judges, has vowed to keep bringing that message to other states. For anyone who thinks, well, strange things might happen out in that part of the country, demonizing judges is an activity that knows no geographic boundaries. When a federal district judge ruled last summer that the government's warrantless wiretapping program was illegal, the Republican National Committee sent a Dear Republican letter to its supporters, pointing out that the judge had been appointed by a Democratic president and asking, quote, "If you are outraged by this latest development, will you sign the petition against this decision weakening the tools we need to fight the war on terror?" Unquote. Congress during its last session considered legislation that would have, among other things, stripped federal courts of their jurisdiction to hear challenges to the phrase "under God and the Pledge of Allegiance." This was known as the Pledge Protection Act. Threatened judges with impeachment for citing foreign sources of law and their opinions, and set up an inspector general with oversight powers over the judicial branch. Of course, few people would maintain that judges should be beyond criticism or that the judicial branch should not be accountable for how it spends taxpayers' money. Nor would anyone, even those few of us here not old enough to have lived through the political crisis engendered by President Roosevelt's court packing plan, maintain that we are seeing something without historical precedent. Judges in our system do exercise enormous power, and tensions over how they use that power are inevitable. But the rhetoric today does seem particularly shrill and has given many close observers the disquieting sense that old norms that have shielded the independence of the courts have begun to wear away. I shouldn't leave this inventory of current problems without mentioning money. You'll hear more about this. Money problems facing the courts come in several varieties. One is the challenge of assuring adequate resources to maintain the court's ability to deliver prompt and efficient justice. Another issue is judicial salaries. In his annual report on the state of the judiciary on New Year's Day, Chief Justice Roberts said that Congress's failure to provide a pay increase was the most urgent problem facing the federal judiciary. Some justices and political leaders have described pay as an issue of judicial independence. Chief Judge Kaye certainly believes this, and you'll hear from her about how the issue looks from the perspective of the state courts, beholden to unsympathetic, if not overly hostile, legislatures. And then in the states with elected judiciaries, there's the problem of the money it takes to run a judicial campaign. Since 2000, candidates for seats on the highest state courts have raised over $156 million, a figure that doesn't take into account the tens of millions of dollars that interest groups have spent on judicial races. In the most recent election cycle, six states broke fundraising records for their judicial elections. A poll commissioned by the nonpartisan public interest group Justice at Stake, which Professor Jay serves on the board of directors, showed that 76% of Americans think that money raised during judicial campaigns affects the outcome of cases in the courtroom. That's a real crisis of confidence in the legitimacy of the courts. So this, too, is a question of judicial independence. Several states with elected judiciaries are seriously considering now public financing of their campaigns. So our challenge this morning is to place these current events in context, to understand the stakes, and with any luck, even to consider how judicial independence might best be protected, not simply for the good of the judiciary, but for the good of all of us. I'll turn first to Justice O'Connor, then to Chief Judge Kaye, and then to Professor Jay. And following their presentations and before taking your questions, I'll invite a distinguished British visitor, Anthony Lester, Lord Lester of Herne Hill, a member of the House of Lords and an honorary foreign member of both of our societies, to give us his perspective. Thanks very much, and now Justice O'Connor.